Hello and welcome to the Hansen Hour podcast, where we spend an hour or thereabouts deep diving into the band Hansen. I'm your host, Megan, and you can join in with me and a special guest each week as we talk about a range of Hansen-related topics. I'm so excited that you are here to join in on this, so grab a cuppa or a glass of red and settle in for an hour of fun. It's guaranteed to make you smile. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of season 1 of The Hansen Hour. This season we're in our middle of nowhere era, and this is an era that really catapulted the band out of Tulsa and onto the worldwide stage, bringing with it a certain mania and hysteria, which honestly I feel really comfortable using those words as I reflect on them. I mean them in a really positive, non-judgmental way. But really cool here today, we have someone that was there to witness it all. Someone who had a front row seat to all this is an incredible man, incredible man named Ravi Hattisingh. Ravi, what I've loved discovering about you through my research is that your life really hasn't been linear. So when I was looking at what you were sort of doing, you do all these different things, and in a world where we're really sort of trying to get more representation, it really hit me because my life has sort of been a little bit like that as well. And I don't think we really see enough people in the spotlight who have, you know, the words that you would use is pivot from this to that. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about what sort of that's been like for you.
Yeah, well, you know, just during the pandemic, I wrote a book called Pivot, and it's probably why you used the word. It is how I define what I've done and the way that I've run my life. And so, you know, it's been that way throughout my life. You know, I was born into a political family, and I quickly pivoted and wanted to become a musician and a guitar player. That was really what attracted me. And then I pursued that. And then, you know, as I'm sure we'll talk about, the adventures that I had in the music industry and how the industry also changed, which just led me to the point where I wanted to pivot again and pursue my other passion in life, which was to become a pilot. And so I got my pilot's license and discovered an interesting statistic during my aviation time, which is that I think it was 49.7% of pilots play a musical instrument. So I realized that I had an interesting network that I could build within the aviation community that centered around music. And I founded an organization, co-founded an organization called the Flying Musicians Association, because there's so many of us in this small community. And we would perform at airports and do all kinds of things. And then in 2015, I developed actually an inner ear disease, which caused me problems with my balance, so I couldn't fly much anymore. And that's when I pivoted again and went into something a little bit more similar to where I came from with my family. And I became a cultural diplomat for the U.S. Department of State and got to do all sorts of interesting cultural programs, again, revolving around music, creating songwriting workshops around the world that bring together people from traditionally opposed cultures and religions. And we launched that in Indonesia, where I had Muslims, Christians, and Buddhists writing songs together. And then we continued that program in Russia with Russians and Ukrainians, in Iraq with Iraqis and Kurds, in Lebanon with Syrians and Lebanese. And again, music was sort of a common thread. And to me, that's the significance of pivot. When you pivot, you have a common thread that you pivot on. It's a pivot point. So for me, music has always been that common thread that has allowed me to pivot through aviation, through cultural diplomacy, and now as a keynote speaker in education. A lot of what I talk about are the importance of arts in education and how it's so important that we keep arts as a fundamental part of education.
Absolutely. I love that. And I love what you say about having a common thread between all these pivots. And I think that that's something that I know has been really important in my life. And that common thread is always, you know, maybe what you're most passionate about or what you sort of always is there. Even if you're doing different things, there is always that one passion that sort of always stands out. And I think, could you speak a little bit, and to me too, about those people that feel like they're constantly pivoting, but maybe not feeling fulfilled or feeling like they just want to give up or let things go because they haven't been able to reach the potential. A lot in my circle of friends, we talk a lot about burnout and feeling like, you know, there is that passion. There's that thing that we feel like we want to do. And looking at someone like you who has taken that passion and really moved into entrepreneurship with it. Well, you know, how can I take this passion and sort of create it into something? For people like me and for anyone else listening who has sort of been in that situation for a while, how do you keep going with the pivots? You know, how do you find that footing?
Yeah, if you can sort of keep reinventing yourself, can be a daunting and tiring task, but it's also very exciting. And, you know, one of the things that where I'm defined in the book, really what pivoting means as opposed to just completely changing everything, as long as you remain true to your fundamental values and to your own strengths and your talents and you use them in different ways, I think that you constantly become re-energized and find new ways to try your skill set and your interests and your passions in a different direction. And the more you do it, the more confident you become and the better you become at it, like any skill. It's sort of practice, you know, makes perfect kind of idea. And so, you know, I think it's really important to persevere. You know, another skill is kind of knowing when to quit and when it's not working in the direction that you're going in, so that you can then open a new chapter. And you know, that just comes with experience and confidence and saying, you know what, I really enjoyed this, but now it's time to move on to something else, you know, as long as you recognize what your own strengths are and what your passions are, I think one can lead a very fulfilling life in all sorts of different directions when your fundamental values and your strengths are the core of your pivot points, as I talk about in the book.
And I think too, having that, something else that I found really helpful is sort of knowing that you're never going to what I call like arrive at the end destination. And I think that's just in life, right? Like you're never going to get to a point where you think, well, this is it. I've arrived, you know, I'm here. It's sort of all downhill from here. We're on that constant journey of growth and learning. And as you would say, pivoting. And I just wanted to bring it back because I know that we could just talk about this sort of stuff for ages, but with a band like Hanson, I did read, it must have been, you know, on a good read. Like there was a very small paragraph that I read of your book, because I will talk to the fact, and anyone listening to this, I've already prefaced Ravi with the fact that I haven't read the book that he wrote called Dancing with Hanson, but I've done a lot of research and Ravi and I have already had a little chat about things. But there was a bit that said, I'll paraphrase, you were sort of in a big stadium and you were feeling like, you know, really emotional about that, because for someone that's been through this pivotal sort of journey back and forth, you felt like Hanson couldn't fully appreciate what that was. And do you think that's because their process was always a little bit linear in the fact that not that it came easy, but, you know, it was quite linear in the way that it all unfolded from my perspective. You may have a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think that's an interesting point. I think what you're referring to, that aspect of the book, and what I was referring to in the book at that time, was that they didn't necessarily appreciate how big this was. And I mean that as a sort of as a compliment to them. It was just part of their life. It was very natural for them. They were young. I mean, they were 11, 14, and 16 when I first met them. And, you know, they were only a year older than that when they had a number one hit and you know, they were the top selling band of the world in 1997. And, you know, it was incredible. The memory that always comes back to me that I think inspired that part of the book was when we did the sound check for the David Letterman show. The first time this was the day that Umbop or Middle of Nowhere was released, May 6th, I think, of 1997. And we were doing the Letterman show. And now I was, Taylor was 14. I was probably 25 at the time. And I remember Taylor turning to me afterwards and sort of saying, "So what is it like to do the Letterman show?" And I looked at him and I said, "I have no idea. I've never done this before. And I've always dreamed of it." So my point is, they never even dreamed of it because they weren't old enough yet to sort of recognize what it was and have that dream. He just sort of thought, doesn't everybody just do this? Aren't we just doing like what everybody does? You know, it's like you go to math class, you go to English class, and you play the Letterman show. So they had this innocence about them that that I really liked and that I really appreciated, because it wasn't that they didn't appreciate it or wouldn't have appreciated it. It was that they couldn't appreciate it because they just hadn't had that life experience to recognize how big of a deal this really was.
Absolutely. So how is it that you came to know Hanson and to be doing this gig with them to begin with? I just want to sort of go back to the start a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, they had recorded this album, Mercury Records. They'd signed a deal a year or two even before I had ever even heard of them. And, you know, they went into the studio and recorded this great album that was very complicated to record. It went way over budget. It took much longer than it should have. And that was for really no reason other than that you're dealing with really young kids. And, you know, that's not a negative towards them. That's just the reality of what it was. So, you know, a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of incredible talent outside of the Hanson brothers themselves went into the making of this record. And then now the record was going to be released and the record company was saying, well, how are we going to pull this off live? How are we going to be able to reproduce and showcase the record at the NARM convention, the National Association of Record Merchandisers, which was my first gig with them in April, I guess, of March of 1997. Can't remember. It was somewhere right around March or April of 97. And so they realized that, like they did in the studio where they had to bring in a lot of people that had more experience, they realized, well, if we're going to sell this record, we're going to have to bring in people that have more experience. And so a friend of mine, I had a recording studio in the suburbs of New York City, in my mother's basement. And one of the clients that I had happened to be in Mercury Records one day when he caught wind of this new band that they were going to launch and overheard that, you know, they needed to get some seasoned musicians in there who looked young and but who could do it. And he just referred me for it. And so Mercury Records just called me and said, you know, we want to send you a tape of this. They sent me a cassette of you know, four or five of the songs off of Middle of Nowhere. And they said, would you be interested? Would you help us out for the NARM convention? And I said, you know, we signed a contract and that was it. I was just going to do the one show. I went to Tulsa, met the guys, rehearsed with them, helped them, showed them, you know, some techniques and helped develop the band along with two other musicians, that seasoned musicians that were brought in. And so the six of us went to work for 8 days of rehearsal in Tulsa. And then we flew down to Florida, to Orlando, I think it was, to do the National Association of Record Merchandisers showcase. And those are all the people that are going to buy the record and sell them in the stores, you know, the big Virgin megastores and the Tower Records and the big distribution. It's the next step, right? The record was recorded. Now we got to figure out how to distribute it and sell it. And so that's what I was brought in to do. And the event was so successful that I went home after that. And a month later, I got a call from Mercury Records. And I remember this so clearly. They said, what are you doing on May 6th? I said, I don't know what's going on. They said, well, would you be available to play the David Letterman show? So well, of course, you know, this was going to be a big step in my career too. And that was really the beginning of my longer term contract with Hanson, was the Letterman show. That was the second gig. And then I was just there for the rest of the ride, up to the Grammy Awards the year later.
Okay, this is really interesting. So I've got two avenues that I need to explore here with that information. The first one I'm going to go, and if I lose my track of thought, then the second one I want to talk about is timing and timelines. So if you can remember that part, and then when I lose my track of thought and tell me that that's what it was. My first track is...
I'll bring you back to timelines.
Yeah, thank you. We had on the podcast Doug Tantro. So he was the recording engineer for Middle of Nowhere, working alongside Stephen Laroni. And he really gave a lot of great information, and a lot of people that listened to the podcast were really surprised to hear that they did get session musicians in to really do most of the music on the album in the end. And again, just like you, so incredibly positive about the talent. It wasn't for lack of talent, right? It wasn't that they weren't good enough. It's just at the time, because of age, that's the way that it ended up. And they were young and they hadn't been playing for that long, and they couldn't have been, like you said, because of just experience, they just hadn't been on the earth for long enough to be that kind of ready for an album, I suppose. So and what you're sort of saying here too is when they've called you in, that it was because they needed a little bit of help on their instruments. Is that right? Like when they were going to go to showcase, because they were still sort of in that infancy stage of playing, to showcase, they wanted to make sure that it was a little bit more robust in the way that it was delivered, would you say?
Yeah, they needed help in every aspect of it. And again, it's not because of what you just said. It's just they didn't have the experience. You know, as I always say, when I think about, Isaac's guitar playing, because I'm a guitar player, and so, a lot of what I had to do was reproduce the guitar playing that was put on the album, which was not played, a lot of it was not played by Ike. And again, that's... As I've said in interviews in the past, Ike was just at the age of 16 then, or 14 or 15 when the album was actually recorded. He just he wasn't a good enough guitar player for a professional record that was going to become hopefully a top selling album in the world. And who could expect somebody of that age to do it? And I often, if anybody were to ask me, was he what kind of a guitar player was he at the age of 16? I'll be the first to say that at the age of 16, he was a better guitar player than I was at the age of 16. So, that has, it's just age. It's just perspective. The only thing that made me more qualified than him is that I was born 9 years earlier than he was.
You had a bit more practice.
So I just had that many more years to do it. Yeah, and I just had more practice, more experience. I had been on stage longer than he had. I had been on tour. I had been in the studio. I mean, it's just time. It's nothing but time. So that's really what the situation was. And it wasn't just about their ability on their instruments. It's just also about how do you put on a show? How do you put on, how do you be a professional when you haven't had the experience that makes you a professional? So that's why, I was brought in and a couple of others as well.
Yeah, because I think it's great to hear you talk about those moments that you were on stage. We've also talked about a lot on the podcast that in this sort of what I call the promo period, right, that you were heavily involved in, because we spoke about you didn't do the Albertine tour, which was that first sort of official tour, but we're doing more the promo stops here. And in that promo, we all just sort of realized when we were sort of unpacking it that we were only seeing tambourines, or Ike might have had, he had, you know, an acoustic guitar, but it was very heavy on the vocals, which is great. We love hearing them like that. But there wasn't, it never even, and it was only like three or four songs at a time. We didn't obviously see anything that was going on apart from the televised stuff that we saw, like Letterman, Rosie O'Donnell, all that sort of thing. The right. stuff that we saw was very raw. So I suppose it's trying to cognitively get your head around how it all worked when it was so layered. So from a fan, a 14-year-old who's just seeing the band, it's only now, like in adulthood, that I'm starting to try and piece it all together, which I suppose is when I said to you that I wanted to go down the line too of timelines. Something that's really been interesting and standing out to me again as an adult is how on earth, because if I'm correct, you guys played, there was something that you played for the industry, and then I think you said then almost like the next day or very soon after that was Letterman, and then from Letterman there was that Paramus, oh, I can never say it right, and Casey, who I had that did this show with me,
Paramus Park Mall.
So how did it
in New Jersey?
How did we as fans come to that mall in the thousands after? And that was the day before Middle of Nowhere was released. So what? How was it all coming together that it got?
It was the day before Letterman, actually.
Right. So it got so big so quick, but not like how does it work?
Yeah. So this is, you know, after my time in Hanson, I started lecturing at music universities quite a lot because it was fascinating to look at how that worked. The industry changed significantly after Hanson. Remember, the internet didn't really exist when Hanson became famous, but a year later it did, and that changed literally changed the world, right? The internet, and it changed the music industry. So your question, how did it happen? Because there wasn't social media, there wasn't all these types of ways to communicate directly. I mean, there was, but it was in such an infancy at the time. And it was very dangerous at the time too. There were people that were impersonating the Hanson brothers and luring young girls to malls, pretending that they were Zach and things like that.
Wow.
And there was very serious stuff going on at the very beginning of the internet. And we were right there. We were a target for that because the band was so big. But prior to that, it was all radio. People knew about Paramus because they were listening to WPLJ in New York, and Scott Shannon was the DJ at WPLJ who broke Hanson to the world, and that is by design. And it is by big business. It's by money. I mean, it's not that Hanson wasn't talented. It's not that they didn't deserve it. They did all of that, but the industry worked with, a lot of payola, illegal payments that were made to radio stations in order to play records it's a whole machine, and some of it legal, some of it illegal, some of it questionable at the time, but that's the way the industry worked. And it was very much by design long before Middle of Nowhere came out, or even before Umbop came out, that this was going to be pushed and be made a number one hit. It had to be. Mercury Records was in desperate need of a number one hit. They didn't have it. They put everything into Hanson to get it. You know, there were, I think, 11 or 12 other bands that were signed the same year as Hanson, and we never heard from them. We never heard them again because all the money went into making sure that Hanson was a success.
So,
I say that and it sort of sounds very calculated and not deserving, but that's just the way the industry worked. And the industry decided that before the public decided, the industry decided Hanson deserved this and that they were going to be the next successful band. And it, as yeah. I've often said too, it's great when good things happen to great people, you know, so, and that's the story of Hanson. So
absolutely. I agree. And I think it's okay to have reflection now. I think it's becoming more and more transparent. I mean, any big business, like, and this is so crazy, but like even things, you know, like Harry and Meghan Markle, or talking about the way that big businesses and big industries work, the transparency coming out now, because as consumers we deserve a little bit more. Well, I guess maybe we've got a little bit smarter. So they can't really do that sort of stuff anymore. And the transparency, you know, as we reflect back, it is just that reflection. And we know now that too, that was something that in the end, now that they've gone independent, again, they gave us that bigger understanding of what sort of machine the record industry is, or was, I think. Even Taylor Swift, you know, Spotify, all that sort of things that have come out. It's really interesting. It's almost like it's so vintage now to talk about the way that the industry was and how they could do it. And also, just again, in adulthood, how manipulated I was in my youth by what I was being fed by industry and consumerism.
Yeah, but I don't want to paint it in a very cynical way either, because it's not necessarily cynical. There were gatekeepers, right? So the record industry and the music that we heard was decided by gatekeepers. But this is true in life for everything. I mean, our movie industry is that way. It still is that way. You know, there are people that decide what movies are going to go into the and they it's not so much that they're controlling us, which is sort of the way it sounds, but they're giving us a service there as well. These industries are providing a service, which says, you know, that there's so much stuff out there, so we are just going to present what we as professionals believe are the best things. You know, going to a restaurant, you want to make sure they're going to serve you the best food. There's no difference really in how the music industry functioned. You know, it's what's on the menu for the music industry. Mm-hmm. This is what's on the menu. Hanson was on the menu. So, you know, so that's what we were literally and figuratively fed. You take the metaphor a little bit further, but but it's a good thing too, because what happens now is you look at the music industry that is just flooded, right, with so much so much material, because anybody can get in. There's not that much. I can write a song today and I can upload it tonight, and it's out there for anybody who wants to hear it. How do we sort through that stuff? You know, we're now looking for Spotify to provide us curated playlists. That's no different than the DJs in the music industry was doing before, because we need that service in order to filter through it. We need that service to some degree.
So I, you know, in terms of bringing two things that we were just talking about together, I was talking about just now about consumerism and what I was being fed. And I've also talked about timelines and timing of things. I wonder if you could sort of answer a bit of a question that has come up on the podcast in terms of, because you do seem to have you have an understanding of the music industry. You were there. As countries were, and I'll use that word fed, and it's not in a negative way, fed different parts of Hanson, or even down to different singles or what we saw, because the internet wasn't a big thing like we were talking about, you know, we had different experiences as Hanson fans depending on what country we were in. For example, we had Alyssa Lederer on, who was the girl that won, she didn't win, she, on the Rosie O'Donnell show, I'm not sure if you remember, she was a Hanson fan that got to go up on stage and meet the band. She came on just to chat about that a little bit. And in that interview, she was talking about an Egos deal that they'd had, that they Waffle were on box. This thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't know what that was. I don't know. So we, in Australia, we weren't getting anything remotely like that. We didn't actually, I don't think, even had the Rosie O'Donnell show. We had Oprah. And we did have Letterman. Letterman's always been on. Things like that. So was it, again, a more curated experience, or was a reasoning behind certain countries getting certain singles? Even I think we even discovered something like Where's the Love wasn't to push album sales. It wasn't released as a single. You could only get it on the album, or I can't remember what one it was specifically, but things like that. Anyway, what do you think?
So, yes, there is a big machine that looks and analyzes all the different countries, all the different revenue models, all of the what works in one country doesn't always work in another country. And it's not just about the song. It's also about what radio stations are there, what the relationships are with the DJs, what television. Hanson was very much of a television band because it was very hard for us to go tour during that time and on the road. And one of the main reasons was child labor laws. These kids were underage and we had to have every third day off, which made the road a very expensive place to be. So television was a great vehicle. And it was also because our fan base was very young. You know, we're not going to really get them out to a stadium, or they're not going to buy tickets necessarily. So, you know, how do we reach them? So a lot of those decisions were based on media. What media is available in what country, at what hour, at what time, you know, who's going to be watching it? And I think that that analysis goes with the songs too. I mean, so much goes into it. When I think about Umbop alone on Rosie O'Donnell versus David Letterman versus any of the other countless times we performed it, it was different every time, based on whether it needed to be cut by 15 seconds or 30 seconds, whether Taylor's voice had changed. We were changing the key of Umbop all the time because of Taylor's voice. So, you know, there were so many things that went into every one of those, so many calculations, from the marketing aspect to just the human aspect of the band to the fatigue of the brothers especially. It was very tiring that year, very hard on those kids. And they had to have school too, by law. We had child labor laws, by law. We had all these different things that had to be factored in. And so part of it, so you have the record company that's interested in record sales. You have, ticket sales weren't a big part of Hanson at that time. It was a promo tour. Everything was free. So there was no revenue model there. But then there was merchandising, and merchandising hadn't been thought of. We didn't even have T-shirts at the first couple of shows. And I remember somebody going, wow, we're really missing the opportunity here. Let's print up some T-shirts, and literally just like printed up what was there. So part of it was very calculated until it became chaotic. And then it was chaotic. And everything was changing. You know, we would get a schedule every night. We had a book that we called the Book of Lies, because we would get another page slipped under our hotel door every night because the schedule for the next day had completely changed. And we just never knew when we were going to go out, where we were going to be, what days we're going to be off. Okay. Because they became so big so fast, and everybody wanted a piece of it all of a sudden. And nobody had experience with this. The management was very inexperienced. The family, it was their first time. And it was an unusual circumstance. I mean, look, the Umbop came out in, what was it, in April, I think, middle of nowhere, in May. The band had sold more than any other band by August of that year, and then nominated for 3 Grammy Awards. I mean, it just moved so fast that nobody knew where to turn or really how to control it at some point. And it was great. I mean, you know, it's a great problem to have, but we played Bill Clinton's Christmas party, White House Christmas party that year. I mean, how many people get to do that? You know, and it was a very exceptional experience an unusual band experience. You mentioned the Eggo Waffle Box. I mean, that was one of many million-dollar endorsement deals that Hanson did, including, a big Got Milk billboard in Times Square in New York.
Oh,
and
the Eggo Waffles. That one.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the milk mustache. You know, all of this stuff was just deal after deal. So that's why the schedule would change. Oh, well, we got to all of a sudden go do a photo shoot with Annie Leibovitz, famed photographer, for a Got Milk commercial that didn't exist yesterday. Now it's going to happen tomorrow. So, yeah. You know, that's why things were just out of control. And when you never know how long it's going to last either. So everybody wanted to make sure that they did as much, said yes to as many possible things as they could. Until it took too much of a toll on the Hanson brothers themselves, and their father, Walker, started to have to say no because he had to look out for his kids at some point.
Yeah. It sounds like such an amazing experience to go through. What would you say, just for fun, like what are some of your really good memories, really fun things that happened?
Yeah. So many good memories. Early on in March, before the world had ever heard of them, when we could all hang out in a McDonald's and nobody would care who who they were. And that all changed just, like a month later. But I remember in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just going and playing laser tag one night and after rehearsal. And it was just really fun. It was bonding. I'm the baby in my family. I have two older brothers. So Isaac and Taylor, Zach were the three younger brothers that I never had growing up. So for me, that was a very special relationship and special experience to go play laser tag, with my quote unquote younger brothers in that. So it's a very fond memory. Then we go out, we have pizza afterwards. And other memories, we were invited by the President William Morris to go watch him. I don't even remember what the movie was, in his private screening room. And I remember, I don't know, I think I came to my hotel room and said, hey, we're going to go watch this movie. You want to come with us? So there was a lot of those moments that were just sort of like family fun experiences with just really nice people, or hanging around the hotel pool and just being a kid and being a goof, that was a lot of fun. But then there were amazing experiences for me, particularly like Madison Square Garden. I grew up in New York, in suburb of New York City, and to play Madison Square Garden and to do it with Aerosmith, and the Wallflowers and all these other bands that I idolized. But Madison Square Garden was a big deal. That was my dream as a child. When am I going to play Madison Square Garden? And I got to live that dream with Hanson. Then, the President of the United States wants you to come and play their Christmas party. I mean, that's something I never could have predicted. But what an amazing experience to be just this far from the leader, the most powerful person in the world. And really, pinch yourself kind of moments. Again, Saturday Night Live was a huge, huge experience for me because it's a show that I had watched, forever. And that was a particularly interesting episode. Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt were the hosts because the movie As Good As It Gets came out that year. And to meet Jack Nicholson, incredible actor. But not only that, it was the Christmas episode of Saturday Night Live that year. And so they had the annual Christmas party. They always have a cast party after Saturday Night Live week, but this was the annual Christmas party. So the old cast members like Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd and all these people that, I grew up with were there at the party, Eddie Murphy, all these people, I mean, it was just amazing. I don't even think the Hansons came to that party because the next day we had to go do the President Clinton's event. But I went to the party and it was just amazing to sort of be in this environment. So for me, that year was just filled with so many great moments of professional music experiences, but also just good sort of family field trip fun experiences that I didn't have really growing up.
Yeah, I love that. It's such nice reflections. And I can't believe it. Chevy Chase, are you serious? That's so cool.
Yeah.
So cool. What about, I mean, and again, I'm just going off reviews that I've read that people say that you mentioned that Hansen were always late, and that's still something in the fandom we talk about now. Hansen time, they are late always. What were some of the more negative? And again, you know what? Like, and I love that every time I have a guest on, there really is no negative, and I think we're all coming from it from a place of like love and understanding. But also, it's a podcast, and we're turning stones, and we're you know deep diving and looking at all the things. So nothing is really a negative. But you know, what were some of the more unenjoyable aspects? You mentioned about the schedule changing and notes being slipped under hotel doors. You know,
yeah.
That must have been really hard.
You know, the unpredictability of the schedule was very hard, and not so much just, I mean, it was an annoyance, you know, the day by day, you know, you get up, you know, you have to go to the lobby at a certain hour, you get there and the schedule's all changed and you have the day off, you know. I mean, a day off is a good thing, you know, it doesn't have to be a negative, but it's just that you suddenly realize you're not in control of your own time. And somebody else is you know, choosing where you're going to be when, and you really have no say in the matter. But that's just the reality of it. I mean, there's not that, you know, it's still a privilege to be part of such an incredible experience. So you have to put up with that. It's funny you mentioned that those comments in the book, because I remember, I mean, you know, that Dancing with Hansen came out in 1999. It was such a long time ago, but I remember that there were comments sometimes or reviews. Negative about how I was being very petty, complaining about the Hansons being late, and how could I take such a petty? But there's a significant reason why I included that in the book, and it simply it explains the title of the book. The book, our sewer manager one day said to me, you know, when the schedule changed yet again, he said to me, "Look, the Hansons, they're going to do what they need to do. The rest of us, we're just dancing." And that's why I called the book Dancing with Hansen, is because it was, that's what it was about. It was about just being, you know, whatever needed to be done, we were all there to do it. You just went with it. You went with the flow. You went with the hard parts. You know, I mean, there were times where we would show up at an airport and we didn't have enough crew or staff to take the passports to the front desk to check it, and you couldn't bring the Hansons there because there'd be a mob scene and paparazzi was following us and stuff. And so there were times where I would just say, give me the passports, and I'd take Isaac Taylor Zach's passports. It wasn't my job, but we all did whatever needed to be done because we were all just dancing, right? We just had to go with it and make it work. So those things were annoyances at the time, but I also, you know, look back at it in perspective and say, you know, that's what made it all work. We all had our little part in it that made it all work. That had nothing to do with why we were there. We were all juggling, catching balls that needed to be juggled because it was pretty chaotic. Paparazzi was a huge problem for us everywhere we went. And it was, you know, I didn't talk about this in the book because the brothers didn't know it at the time, but there were a lot of kidnapping threats. You know, during that tour. And I was positioned on the stage in a pretty interesting place. I had a pretty good vantage point. And so I had a code with our head of security that if I saw something strange, I would give him the code from the stage. And, you know, those are things that the Hansons never knew about because they didn't need to know about that. They shouldn't know about that. But those were some of the, I guess, sort of the negative things that we had to deal with. And then, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, for me, the most negative aspect of it, which is still a big negative, was when I was fired from the band, very unexpectedly. To this day, 25, 27 years later, nobody's ever explained it to me. And, you know, so that would be the sort of big negative that isn't consistent with my own experience with who they are and who the organization was. And I would never hold that against the guys themselves. I'm sure they don't. I know I did see them once afterwards. Isaac just came up to me and said, "Hey, I heard you got too busy for us." So they weren't even told what, you know, what that I was actually fired. They thought I quit. And, and I just sort of left it at that. But I've never gotten an explanation for that. And this is just where I would say that sometimes organizations get, and I mean organizations, I don't mean the brothers themselves, but I mean organizations as a whole, become a little arrogant, they become a little short-sighted, they don't take care of the people that took care of them, and that were part of it. And, for me, the first gig that I didn't play with the Hansons was the Grammy Awards, Radio City Music Hall in New York. I practically begged them to let me play that, and nobody responded to my request. And the reason why I wanted to play that is because the Grammy Awards was the celebration of all the work that we did together. It was the acknowledgement. And I strongly felt that they should have let me just do that. Why? I wrote them a letter. I don't know if they ever saw it or ever got it, but simply saying, hey, it's your band, it's your family. I totally respect that. But I was part of this since the beginning. And this is the acknowledgement of all of our work together. And I would love to be part of that. And then, it'd be cool. But they didn't give me that opportunity. So that is the biggest negative that I carry, through today.
Oh, yeah. I think you summed it up really well, hearing you talk about all these good times. And then the word that you used was inconsistency to the experience that I had. And I can imagine that would be really challenging. You've had a really great time, the way you talk about it with such passion. And then there is this sort of big inconsistency at the end that has that negative connotation or energy around it. And then that's where it sort of ends. And that must be a really tricky thing.
Right. And it remains unresolved.
Yeah. And it remains unresolved. I had wanted to talk about that because it looked like in the end things went that little bit pear-shaped or went south a little bit. We still don't know what happened. You're assuming that it was we know because Isaac's come up and spoken to you, it's an industry decision or something to do with the business.
I wouldn't say it's an industry decision. It's an organizational, meaning it came from within the Hansen organization. It could have been the parents. Mm. It could have been whatever it was. But what I do know is that I wasn't the first and I wasn't the last. They went through a series of unexplained firings of people in the organization. Part of it was I have some information, but the parents wanted, to their credit, they wanted to protect their children. And I think that they felt that having a rotation of people that were around them prevented anybody from getting too close, because anybody that gets too close could be a threat to their business, to their, and there were other things. I had been there for a while. There were always Isaac Taylor Zach signs in the audiences. And then towards the end of my time, there were Ravi signs in the audiences too. And I don't think they really liked that much. The parents, at least, I don't think really liked that. The record company loved it. They said, we don't care. The more publicity, the more promotion, and the more people that like the band or whatever way, that's great, right? It's fine. But I can understand from a family perspective, they're thinking, well, maybe we're losing control of this a little bit. And so maybe we just need to, cycle and change and do some things. So there's a lot of speculation. All of it is, I think, understandable. But it would be great if it had been explained at the time. So all of this to say, it taints my view of the whole thing quite significantly. But it doesn't change my opinion of who Isaac Taylor and Zach are. And that is three really good, really talented, nice people.
Yeah, I love that. Well, let's end on a little bit of a high. When you were playing with the band, what were some of your favorite songs to play? And, what sort of reactions did you see coming from the crowds? I'm assuming even in televised audiences, there's still a lot of girls in the audience. Well, I guess if you're just playing Mbop and Where's the Love, but was there sort of a more fun thing to play or a more fun experience on the stage for you?
You know, well, in terms of songs, I mean, my favorite song, I think, was always Thinking of You. And I think the reason why Thinking of You was my favorite song was it was the first song of Hanson I ever heard on the demo that Mercury Records sent me. That was the first song. Umbop was the second. And I think Where's the Love was the third. I thought Umbop was the weakest out of the three. You know, and I was actually surprised when the record company decided that they were going to make that the single. You know, obviously they knew exactly what they were doing. But for me, Thinking of You and Where's the Love were stronger songs, were just better songs. And I always enjoyed playing those a lot. We used to open a lot of our shows, I think, with Thinking of You. And I can't remember, but I wouldn't be surprised if I influenced that decision, because for me, it was the first song I ever heard of them. And I always thought it was strong and powerful and a great way to open a show. And so we opened a lot of our shows with that. Where's the Love, I think, is just a brilliant song. And so I always thought that, you know, that was just a lot of fun to play. You know, Minute Without You was another good one, because Isaac and I had a little guitar break in the middle of it that we did. So he and I always had this kind of interaction and exchange on stage, just when the two guitars were playing that middle section of Minute Without You. So, you know, it was those are sort of the moments in the musical on stage moments that I remember. But, you know, some of the best memories are just the jams and rehearsals and the fun that we were having when nobody was watching. And those are a lot of the really good times.
So you don't follow the band anymore. You don't get to live shows or anything. A lot of the times they still do open with Thinking of You, because it's such a sort of classic start to a, you know, and we've actually unpacked that song on the podcast. It's a lot of people's favorite songs. It's such a good one. But so in terms of contact or still sort of being involved in their music, it's a no from you.
Yeah, I haven't. No, I really have. You know, I of course think about them. It was a very important part of my career, but it was 1 year of my life, you know, so. While it was a big moment and a big experience in my life, and while it was an incredible learning experience for me and an education for me, and you know, I think that I've moved on now to so many other things that interest me, you know, more, for lack of a better word, I guess they interest me more. But so I don't really keep up with them. I mean, you know, Hanson was it was a very difficult time. At the time when I left, it was a very difficult time for the music industry and for Hanson. You know, they fell off the map to a large degree during the following year. I mean, the Albertine tour was reasonably successful. And then their album after album was coming. This Time Around came out, which I thought was such a great album, but it was such a commercial failure. And they couldn't. They just couldn't recover from that, and it's such a shame, because it's a really great album, but the record industry, the record company that signed them, Mercury Records, no longer existed. Nobody that was behind the band, Steve Greenberg, Danny Goldberg, all these people that I worked with, none of them were you know, behind the band anymore. They had all gone on to other things, and Hanson wound up on Def Jam Records. That didn't know what to do with a pop band. They were a rap label, basically. And so when the whole thing, when Mercury PolyGram was sold to Seagram, Seagram sold to Universal, Universal consolidated all of these PolyGram labels into one Def Jam Island that was run by a bunch of rap label executives, they really didn't care about Hanson. And then you have this great album like This Time Around comes out, and nobody did anything with it, and it was a commercial. That to me was the end of Hanson as a big band. Now they were very, very clever and very smart, thanks to being around some very smart people like Peter Gabriel, who helped them develop one of the first subscription models, with their fans now becoming subscribers. This that really didn't exist much before Hanson did it. So I have a lot of respect for the fact that they, rather than just quitting and ending it, which they probably could have done, they probably had made enough money where that wouldn't have been a concern. They decided to be business people, and they decided to say, you know what, we're going to do our three-car garage, or we're going to build our studio, we're going to create our own label, we're going to start a subscription model. And you know, the band just shrunk and shrunk in the eyes of the public, but the machine was growing, you know, as a business that they owned, which is very commendable. You know, even the beer company, Hops, you know, that put them on the cover of Entrepreneur magazine. I mean, you know, they did a lot of really cool things that I think that they deserve to be admired, commended, and respected for, even though they fell out of the limelight.
And I think hearing you, Ravi, talk about from your perspective as someone that was in there, when I did start off talking about hysteria and mania, from the way that you've sort of been talking about it too, it's almost a good thing that they've managed to have the level of a success still, even if that's not seen as commercial, that they have had now, just even for mental health and well-being, or as you've mentioned, safety. You know, it seems like it got pretty out of control in terms of that popularity, and that couldn't have been sustained to the level that they've been able to sustain themselves now as well.
Yeah, and I would say that it could have gotten out of control. It didn't. I don't believe it got out of control. I believe that they contained it reasonably well to prevent it from getting out of control. But it was on the verge at times, you know. I mean, it was definitely, you know, we had the situations that you see in the old Beatles. We talk about hysteria. I mean, I remember we each had our own van sometimes leaving a concert. And I remember being in my van heading out of, I don't know, some stadium somewhere, and just being mobbed by fans and moms. That was a lot of it. and the van being rocked back and forth all the time and things like that. You know, it was just really crazy at some times.
Do you think that was enjoyable for them? I mean, it's great to have that level of success, and obviously that's what you want, like you said, a good problem to have. But do you think there was a time where it just was a little bit too much? And you talk about them fatiguing and being tired, and that was sort of a hard year. Do you think that it ever got to them, you know?
Yeah, it definitely got too much. It got too tiring for them. It was a very hard year. They were just too young to sustain that level of schedule. And you know, I think that's just why things had to change and things had to slow down a little bit. But, you know, again, I think the year was literally a whirlwind, and they didn't understand to some degree. They didn't have the perspective to understand how successful they really were. And I think that's a good thing. It was just every day, you know, we're a band, this is what we do, we assume every other band does this too, kind of attitude. That probably changed after I left, and because there was a gap after that. There was a gap of time where before the next tour, and I have a feeling that they started to realize at that point maybe that they were extraordinary. You know, this was out of the ordinary what they had experienced. And I don't know what happened to their personalities as a result, because I didn't really keep in touch with them that much afterwards. I don't know if it affected them, you know, in different ways, and if they became different people because of it. I suspect probably not, but I don't really know, because it does affect you. But it didn't affect them. They were just three really innocent, talented, loving brothers, you know, that were just enjoying the moment without realizing how big of a moment it really was.
Well, Ravi, we're hitting the hour mark. I just wanted to finish off by getting you just to chat with us a little bit about what you're doing now and how everyone can find you or, you know, get involved in anything that you're doing, because you are doing some amazing things now. So if you could just talk us through, yeah, a little bit about what's going on for you.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I predominantly now give keynote speeches in the education industry, and it's because I believe that in education, we need to make sure that we are giving our students the ability to pivot, as we started talking about at the beginning of this. And, you know, that's something that a skill that I think I've developed and that has led me to do a lot of really interesting things and have a pretty fulfilling life. And so I started thinking about that at some point some years ago, about how do we bring that into our education system? How do we make sure that as people are starting to live longer and people are going to have to sustain careers and families for a longer period of time, how do we give them the education to do that in just 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 short years? You know, how do we prepare them for an unpredictable future? And the only way we can do that is by teaching kids how to learn and to always make sure that they use every opportunity to learn. And I just remember that's how I always viewed Hanson, is as a learning opportunity. I wanted to be in the music business. Now I was going to be in the music business at the top level. I wanted to make sure that I could learn as much from this experience as possible and learn from the industry executives. You know, I remember backstage at shows, I would sit with Danny Goldberg. I mean, who has the opportunity to be with Nirvana's manager, former manager, now, you know, record label executive, that and just sit there and pick his brain and learn from him? Well, I had that opportunity. So, you know, what I want our education system to do is to teach kids how to have the confidence to recognize those opportunities and to capitalize on those opportunities and you know, and to see all of their experiences as a learning opportunity that can lead them to the next thing. So, you know, that's primarily why I now speak to education leadership and share my experiences and what I've discovered through the music industry, aviation industry, cultural diplomacy, and traveling around the world, how it has empowered me to be a lifelong learner, and how I think it's our job as educators to empower all students to become lifelong learners.
Ravi, thank you so much. It has been such a joy to have you on. So thank you so much for your time and energy.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great. Always great to talk about Hanson. So many positive feelings and such a great experience. And it's nice for me to see that you and your listeners still care, because as I said at some point during our conversation, it's great when good things happen to great people. And to me, that is the story of Hanson. And so it's nice that people still care about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people still care about you as well. And I hope that that's a good takeaway for you, because when I started this podcast, I am starting right at the middle of nowhere. And I really, there's so much to sort of sift through. And I put out to, you know, our beautiful Hanson community, like, who should I get on? Like, who should help me pull this apart and then piece it back together? And everyone was like, Ravi, like, you got to get Ravi. You know, I think that you're still so well loved in the community. So there's that as well.
Well, thank you. It's and I love the community. One thing that, you know, that I, one very fortunate thing that I could do that the Hanson brothers could not do is hang out with the audience. And I used to do that. Mm-hmm. When we would go play somewhere, I would take a security guard before the show, and I'd walk through the stands and the stadiums and just greet people. Because I feel the same way with my keynote speaking audiences. I just love to get to know the audiences and get to know the community, because those are the people that make it all possible. The fans are the people that make it all possible. And I know the Hansons would love to have done that too, if it wasn't such a security nightmare. But I was lucky to be the one that was able to do that. And so I appreciate the community and appreciate your listeners.
Thank you so much, Ravi.
Thank you.